The other day, someone went out of their way to convince me that America was a racist country. And to prove their point, they shared video clips like this.
A hotel in Oregon faces a lawsuit after an African-American guest was escorted by police off the premises. The hotel has apologized and has fired two employees. Ileana Diaz explains what happened.
Portland police will be here in a minute.
Thank you. Call them. I'm waiting.
Okay.
They're coming. Why? Why are they coming?
To escort you off the property.
Because what? And I'm staying here?
A week after Jermaine Massey was kicked off the property of this DoubleTree Hotel in Portland, Oregon, management has taken action and fired two employees. Massey was in the lobby on the phone with his mother when he was approached by security. According to him, the white guests were not questioned.
It seems like we are talking about these viral videos of people of color dealing with calls to police for ordinary, non-criminal things every day. In the past few days, stories surfaced about Native American students attending a college tour reported by a suspicious parent. A black grad student who fell asleep in a common area in her dorm reported by a white fellow grad student. And a group of friends who were detained by police while they were checking out of their Airbnb rental reported by a white neighbor of the homeowner. And the Airbnb guests and their lawyer are calling on Rialto police to hold the caller accountable.
My response to those clips is this. There is racism in America, but America as a whole is not a racist country. Up until Loring versus Virginia, which is a famous case in 1967, up until then, it was illegal to marry someone of another race here in the United States. There was a recent film made about this, actually. Do we have the trailer for that?
Richard Perry Loving being a white person and Mildred Jeter being a colored person did unlawfully cohabitate as man and wife.
Richard?
That ain't right!
I believe this is a battle that could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
We ain't hurting anybody.
The state of Virginia will argue that it is unfair to bring children of mixed race into the world.
Tell that woman to come over here.
I won't raise my family here. I don't care what they do to us.
Get Peggy inside!
I can take care of you.
I know that.
I can take care of you.
The Pew Research Center has done a lot of studying on the topic of interracial relationships. And let me share a few, some interesting quotes from their study, right? So this first quote, yeah, bring it up. Okay, so this first quote says this. In 1967, when miscegenation laws were overturned in the United States, 3% of all newlyweds were married to someone of a different race or ethnicity. Since then, intermarriage rates have steadily climbed. By 1980, the share of intermarried newlyweds had about doubled to 7%. And by 2015, the number had risen to 17%. And if you look at census data, the upward trend of interracial marriage is reflected there as well. We have a chart for that too. Yeah, thank you. All right, so this is from the U.S. Census Bureau, and you look here of, this is just black and white marriages. If you look at the number here from 1980, 167,000 to 2009, 550,000. So definitely on the upward swing. Now, that's just the marriage side of things. That doesn't account for cohabitation. Or as I used to call it back in my day, shacking up. when it comes to cohabitation, this is what Pew Research Center had to say about that because they studied that phenomenon as well. Bring up those, yeah. Okay, so here's some numbers around that. A half century after the Supreme Court legalized interracial marriage in the United States, 18% of all cohabitating adults have a partner of a different race or ethnicity. 18%. That's almost, one in five? Is that right? Is that right? Yeah, almost one in five. Okay, let me get back to it. Among cohabitating U.S. adults, those living with an unmarried partner, millennials and members of Generation X are particularly likely to have a live-in partner of a different race or ethnicity. Roughly one in five in each group do. And here's another quote. Pew Research also pointed out that 46% of Asians live with someone of a different race, 24% of Hispanics live with someone of a different race, and 28% of Blacks live with someone of a different race. If America is so racist, why is there a trend, an upward trend on interracial marriages? And for that matter, if America is so racist, why are so many of us living with people, shacking up, cohabitating with people of different races? And here's some more data from Pew Research Center. And it says here The Pew Research is recent. The Pew Research, can I say it right? The Pew Research Center. All right, let's do it again. The Pew Research Center's report on racial attitudes in the U.S. finds that an overwhelming majority of millennials, regardless of race, say they would be fine with a family member's marriage to someone of a different racial or ethnic group. Millennials are about equally accepting of marriage to someone in any of the groups tested. Roughly 9 in 10 say they will be fine with a family member's marriage to an African-American at 88%, Hispanic-American at 91%, an Asian-American at 93%, or a white-American at 92%. All right. Well, I think I beat that horse to death. I have one other point to make, too. If America is so racist, then why are there so many interracial adoptions? Yeah, I looked into that too. Check this out. Bring up this stat. Okay. So this stat comes from the Institute of Family Studies. A recent study from the Institute of Family Studies reveals that transracial adoptions have increased by 50%. All right? I read them right? Yeah. 50% over the last decade. All right. So finish reading that. So 50% over the last decade, specifically the proportion of adopted kindergartners being raised by a mother of a different race or ethnic group has increased 50% between 1999 and 2011. Interesting, a bit dated. So I wanted to find something a little bit more recent. So I did some searching and came across this stat. Was interesting. This came from the American Enterprise Institute. Yeah. Okay. So this is. Let me read a quote here. The National Children's Bureau estimated that by 1972, 15,000 American families had adopted children of another race, including African Americans and Asians. And despite continuing controversies about transracial adoption, transracial meaning you adopting children from another race. That's all that means. Okay, so when you're about transracial adoption, from 2002 to 2012, 21 to 24%, that's almost like one in four almost, right? One in five to one in four almost, somewhere in there. All right, so 21 to 24% of domestic adoptions of children under the age of two were transracial. Now, as I said, I found that information from the American Enterprise Institute. They published, that came from this report, which when you see the title, you'll see why it caught my eye, all right? So the title of the report where I got that information from was this, Transracial Adoption in the Time of Black Lives Matter, all right? And for the benefit of those who may be against transracial adoptions, let me share another quote from the same report. All right, and that quote is this. Transracial adoption, particularly of Black children by white parents, has aroused controversy for more than 50 years, especially after being famously denounced by the National Association of Black Social Workers in 1972. But the empirical evidence of of transracial adoption suggests strongly that Black children adopted into white families suffer no more developmental or adjustment problems than Black children in Black families. Given the significant shortage of Black families available to adopt Black children from foster care, opposition to transracial adoption does not serve those who need a permanent family. Some people believe that America is a racist country. I don't believe that. I don't believe that because there are so many interracial marriages and that trend is not slowing down. I don't believe it because there are so many interracial couples living together. I don't believe it because dating someone of a different race is not taboo, certainly not like it was back in the 60s and so on. And I don't believe America as a whole is racist, because if it were, there would not be so many transracial adoptions. As I said before, 21 to 24% of domestic adoptions are transracial. That being said, does that mean that there is no racism in America? No. Not saying that. There are some racist people in America, but America as a whole is not racist. It's hard for me to accept that we can love one another, we can live with one another, we can adopt one another, but at the same time, be so racist. Doesn't make sense to me. Does it make sense to you? Did you hear about this? A school in Denver is sponsoring a whites-only playground event. Yes, apparently there are some parents and a school in Denver who feel that it is appropriate to have a whites-only children playground event in Denver. Well, what are we, back in the Jim Crow era? Are we going to have to march for civil rights again? This is so bizarre to me. How racist is it to have a whites-only playground event? Well, if you're in Denver and you feel that way, there's certainly a place for you because, sorry about that. It was not a whites-only playground event. It was a playground event for people of color only. Still upset? Whites were not allowed to attend. Believe it or not, there are other events like this taking place in our country today. The reason for it, I believe, is because of the teachings of CRT, critical race theory, something I feel is a scourge on our nation. I discussed critical race theory with my guest, Dr. Carol Swain, who is the author of Black Eye for America, How Critical Race Theory is Burning Down the House. And this was our conversation. Answer. There is a big push from the left to get everyone on board with critical race theory. It goes to the point of calling parents who are against it domestic terrorists. I've seen articles where I believe it was in Phoenix, Arizona, where teachers are given bonuses when they teach this type of teaching, this type of curriculum, yes, in their classroom. Why is there such a big push for CRT when it's obvious that so many parents are against CRT?
Well, first of all, the political left will tell you that CRT is not being taught in classrooms, that it's only taught at the university level. And so you have some educators who will actually admit, yes, we're doing it. It's for the benefit of everyone. And if you oppose it, you're a racist. So that's one side of the divide. But mostly we're told that CRT is not being taught in the classrooms, and it clearly is being taught in the classroom. And it also is being taught in different forms, because other people who say that critical race theory is not being taught, they may say, no, we're not doing that. We're doing culturally sensitive learning. We're just teaching about social justice. We're just teaching about educational equity. We're just teaching civil rights. But they're teaching it in a manner that divides the students, or divides the world into oppressors who are white and non-white victims. And it argues that racism pretty much is in the DNA of this country, but also of white people, and that all white people are born with white privilege, and they have a property investment in their skin color. They need to divest themselves of their race. And it really is a reverse racism against white people. It argues that only white people can be racist, and that only white people have an obligation to condemn racism. And so that's sort of how critical race theory is manifesting itself. But when you talk with people, they say it's not happening. It is happening, and it's happening as early as kindergarten. And if you look at some of the research out there, there are people that make the absurd argument that babies can be racist by 6 months. The evidence for that is that in some of the studies, babies preferred certain faces to others. Now, I don't know about you, but if I were a baby, I would favor the faces who were feeding me and changing my diapers, the ones that I saw every day. I don't care whether they were Black or white or Asian. I'm going to favor those faces that are familiar.
I think one of the ways they classify CRT is also social emotional learning. Have you heard of that?
Yes, SEL, definitely. And what they do is it's very subjective. And the teachers pretty much indoctrinate children. They have a an ideal of how a person is supposed to think and respond and or behavior. And they are able to evaluate students in a way that can be very harmful, because it involves pushing a particular agenda. And if your child doesn't respond the way they're supposed to respond according to the script, then they could be evaluated in a way that would be negative for that child. There could be notes put in their record, or they could be graded in some cases. And it's all subjective. It's based on the teacher's values and the curriculum. And what's dangerous about CRT is that a lot of the teaching materials come from above. You know, they come either from the government or they come from the school board, and teachers are told to teach to the materials. In fact, they can get in trouble and be punished if they deviate. And so they have statements, and they're supposed to pretty much regurgitate what's in those statements. And we know that's not teaching. That is not real teaching, but that's how CRT is structured. It's pure indoctrination. It does not allow for critical thinking, nor does it foster critical thinking skills.
You know, it struck me that CRT is sort of, it's not just teaching of CRT itself, but it is a doorway to other types of critical theories.
Yes, definitely.
Can you talk more about the different, talk more about the critical theories that are related to critical race theory and how they can affect our youth and
society? Well, the thing is that critical race theory is only one of several or many different critical theories, and they all grow out of cultural Marxism. And if you were to Google cultural Marxism, most of the articles that would come up would say it's a white wing conspiracy that's anti-Semitic, that it's not real. And 8 years ago, if you Googled cultural Marxism, you'd actually get articles on what cultural Marxism is and its roots to Antonio Gramsci and Herbert Marcuse and some of the Marxists that looked at the failure of economic Marxism. They studied it, and they decided that the problem was rooted in the culture, especially Western culture, its Judeo-Christian roots. And so cultural Marxism is about tearing down the traditional societal structures, whether it's the government, the church, the family, and they use different methods to do that. And so you have critical queer theory. That's one reason that the homosexual agenda is being pushed so strongly in, you know, K-12. That's a form of critical queer theory. There's critical gender theory, this whole idea that there's not, you know, two sexes, but you can have like 64 genders because genders are socially constructed. There's critical feminist theory that argues that men and males are the oppressors and women are the victims, and girls, they're all victims. And so whenever you have a critical theory, part of the argument is that society is structured in a way that one group has an advantage. They are the oppressors, and the other group is oppressed, and it could be rich versus poor. There are many, many critical theories, and they are all designed to take down traditional structures and culture as we know it.
Everything you said just resonates with me at how divisive this type of teaching is. And I understand why a lot of parents are taking their kids out of school and they're homeschooling their children, not exclusively because of critical race theory, but certainly that's a part of it. Do you think that once a significant number or significant percentage of parents have taken their children out of school because they don't want their kids taught this, that there would be some sort of government mandate saying that you have to teach this to your children at home, even though you're homeschooling? Do you think that's a possibility?
This has been going on for a few years, but there have been cases of parents who were conservative who lost their children because sometimes it might be the other parent that did not like conservative values and principles being taught. And I believe that the government wants to indoctrinate all of our children. And the more parents that choose homeschooling, the more of a threat that is to government education and to the teachers unions. And we know that the teachers unions and are very powerful, so much so that they were able to go to the Department of Justice and to get parents who were concerned about the education of their children pretty much labeled as domestic terrorists. And that backfired because it actually led to more parents standing up. The parents did not cower in, with fear and intimidation because they care about their children and the lives of their children. And so it kind of backfired and was embarrassing on the DOJ, but they still have that as part of their policy, that if parents speak up too vociferously at a meeting, they may be on the FBI watch list, so they may be arrested. And I think that the government certainly plans to come after your children. I would also argue that they devalue human lives at every stage. And a lot of the policies that they're pushing now, even with the masking in school and the online learning, is detrimental to all of our children, but they don't care. And so we need to realize that the government has an agenda, and that agenda is to make Americans docile. They want your children to infect them and indoctrinate them with their secular humanist goals that are rooted in cultural Marxism. And that's the state of affairs, and you need to know what you're dealing with.
Dr. Swain, you've been very generous with your time. Before you go, please tell us a bit more about your new book.
Anyone that gets my book, Black Eye for America, How Critical Race Theory is Burning in the House, will find a book that's very accessible, but it will talk about the roots of CRT and its connection to other theories. And it has a glossary because they are constantly changing the meaning of words. So it has a glossary, as well as appendices of resources, other organizations that you can connect with, as well as the model school board language. And anyone who reads the book, and it's a short book, they can be well equipped to debate anyone about this issue that's so important for us all to learn and know about.
Dr. Carol Swain, amazing as always. Thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate
it. It's my pleasure.
The Jim Stroud Show will return after these special messages. This episode of The Jim Stroud Show brought to you by Conservative Television of America, working hard to stick socialism where the sun don't shine. Conservative Television of America is now available on Fire TV Stick, Roku, and on the Conservative Television of America website. Tune in now at www.ctva.tv. Conservative Television of America. We say what you're thinking. And the Jim Stroud Show is back. Thanks for watching. Leo, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. A friend of mine was sharing different articles with me, and yours stood out to me because I thought, wow, this is one of those things that is beyond X-Files, and it's also it's also beyond left and right. So I really wanted to touch base with you on it. You wrote an article, then bring it to your remembrance. The article's title is The Real Agenda Behind Mad Dash to Get Every Child on the Planet Injected Against a Virus That Won't Affect Them. And that really raised my eyebrows because I know from reading other stories that the possibility of children being infected with COVID-19 is very, very small, almost, I think, less than zero chance. But there's this big push to get them vaccinated.
Yeah, let's clarify that less than zero chance that they could die of it.
Okay.
But yeah. there's a lot of kids get COVID, but it amounts to the sniffles, you know, it almost none of them get hospitalized and even fewer of them end up, you know, dying from it.
That is what I meant. Thanks for the clarification. That being said, there is still to your article and the other articles I've read, there is this big push to get more children vaccinated. Why do you think that is?
Well, I, like you, wanted to get the answer to that question. And so I started investigating, and what I found, I already had some knowledge, Jim, about what was going on with Agenda 2030. If you read the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations Agenda 2030, you will see in there, for instance, Goal 3.8, which talks about providing vaccines for all children and making sure all children get vaccinated. And then if you go over to goal 16.9, you'll see where it talks about assigning a birth registration and a digital identification to all children at birth. And it talks about birth registration for all children. And it says no child should be left behind. No person should be left behind. And of this new digital ID system. And when you start going from there and investigating what they mean by this birth registration, quote unquote, you find out that they're looking for a biometric ID and one that would be recognized globally under a new digital ID system. And so the interesting part, I'd already known that, but what I didn't know is that the two are tied together. The drive to vaccinate every child on the planet fits in with the drive by the same group of people to make sure that we all have a new digital ID system that includes biometric data, you know, fingerprints, retina scans, whatever they can get to identify us would be included in this data, the data points of this new global ID system. And then I started investigating further, and I came across this document that was published in 2018 by Bill Gates' Gavi Vaccine Alliance. This is a multi-billion dollar organization funded by the US government and other governments, along with Gates and the Gates Foundation. And they published a paper in 2018 about their INFUSE program, INFUSE. It's called the INFUSE program. And basically what this is a propaganda campaign to get big tech, big banks, and everybody involved and on board in this new global ID system, which will be tied to what? Children's vaccine status. And but they admit, as you read this document, that it's about more than just vaccines. As we go along, we can read some from the document, because I don't want people just to take my word for it. I want it to be in the words of the Gavi Vaccine Alliance, which is an international organization, a nonprofit corporation started by Bill Gates, funded by him and the US government and other governments to push vaccines on a global basis, because you know Bill Gates is hugely into vaccine and vaccines and has been for at least 20 years now.
Yes.
About 20 years ago, he started shifting the bulk of his investments away from computers and into vaccines. And he said that it's been hugely profitable for him, that his net worth has, you know, quadrupled. And he said that his return on investments, nothing is like vaccines. He said he has a 20-to-1 return on investment. This is him, not me, admitting that how profitable the vaccine industry has been. So he's been pushing it relentlessly and buying off the media to push his narrative that we need to shift to this vaccine-based healthcare system where everything now has, they want a vaccine for basically everything. And he's bought, when I say bought off the media, Columbia Journalism Review did that. You're familiar with that publication?
I am.
Okay, yeah. For your listeners, they're sort of a trade publication for the national media. And they did a report a couple of years ago and found that Bill Gates had invested, his Gates Foundation had awarded $250 million in grants to mainstream media publications and TV stations. It was like the BBC, NPR, the CBC in Canada, The Guardian in the UK, The Atlantic Magazine, The Washington Post. All of these huge outlets have accepted grants from the Gates Foundation to cover his pet issues. And what are Bill Gates' pet issues? Basically, there's two: vaccines and climate change. So whenever you see the BBC, NPR, the Washington Post reporting on vaccines and climate change, there's a good chance that their investigative reporting is funded, at least in part, by the Gates Foundation. And people don't know this. So it's an extreme conflict of interest. And the Columbia Journalism Review article pointed out that this was just the money that they could track. A lot of it, they said, was not trackable. So it's likely way more than $250 million. And they said that this is compromising these media outlets. They have a conflict of interest. And they actually proved in this Columbia Journalism Review article that these news outlets have been putting forth biased reporting on the two issues most important to Bill Gates.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because it makes me wonder, could you have impartial news reporting if you're getting $250 million from someone who gets a 20-to-1 return on that investment? It's it's amazing to me. And it also somewhat makes me wonder why I don't see much in terms of news reporting in terms of prevention. You know,
right.
What can you do to prevent getting this? You hear about the hand washing and the sanitation and the masks from time to time, but you don't hear much about vitamin D or sunlight or getting into shape and not being obese. And
getting sleep.
Yeah. You don't hear about a lot about preventative measures that will keep you from getting into that position, only that you need to get the shot. And do you think that is purely a financial incentive, which is why that is?
I think that's the biggest reason. I mean, it's not just Gates pouring money into these so-called news outlets, but you look at the big pharma companies, Jim. I mean, it's hard to turn on CNN without seeing, you know, Anderson Cooper Tonight, brought to you by Pfizer.
Because brought to you by Pfizer.
CBS Health Watch, sponsored by Pfizer.
Anderson Cooper 360, brought to you by Pfizer.
ABC News Nightline, brought to you by Pfizer.
Making a difference, brought to you by Pfizer.
CNN Tonight, brought to you by Pfizer.
Early Start, brought to you by Pfizer.
Friday night on Aaron Burnett Out Front, brought to you by Pfizer.
This Week with George Stephanopoulos is brought to you by Pfizer.
This weather report brought to you by Pfizer.
Today's countdown to the royal wedding is brought to you by Pfizer.
And now a CBS Sports Update brought to you by Pfizer.
Meet the Press Data Download, brought to you by Pfizer.
This portion of CBS This Morning, sponsored by Pfizer.
On how to find the hidden sugars in the American family diet, sponsored by Pfizer.
You know, sure. I mean, how are we supposed to expect them to deliver unbiased, impartial reporting that just is looking at getting to the facts when they're taking money from the biggest corporations that stand to benefit from the sale of vaccines at our expense, by the way? You know, all these vaccines were purchased with U.S. tax dollar money. And, you know, it's just a humongous gravy train for these vaccine companies. They get to put out a product. They're shielded from all liability since like 1986 or 88. I don't remember the exact date, but it was in the late 80s. Reagan was president. And we passed a big healthcare law in that shielded vaccine makers from liability. So you can't sue them if their product ends up harming you. And then you've got the Gates Foundation, which helped you develop these vaccines, pouring money into news outlets to give you favorable coverage. Then you've got the government trying to mandate the vaccines and other big corporations trying to mandate. Wouldn't you love to be in a business like that where you could put out a product, not have to worry about it failing because nobody could sue you for product liability? And then you have the government and the world's biggest corporations giving you free advertising for that product. Wouldn't that be great?
It all sounds very suspect when you mention it like that. As you were talking about these new technologies and this unlimited support that they're getting from government, several things pop in my head. I'm thinking about different references from pop culture. I'm a big James Bond fan. And in one James Bond film, Q, who gives James Bond all his gadgets, injected him with something called Smart Blood, which allowed his computers to track James Bond wherever he goes. In case he's ever was in trouble, they would know how to find him.
What is it?
Cutting edge nanotechnology. Smart Blood. Microchips in your bloodstream allows us to track your movements in the field. You see those readouts? We can monitor your vital signs from anywhere on the planet.
That sounds marvelous.
And when I saw that, I also remembered a report. I think it was on 60 Minutes, not quite sure where I saw it. But there actually was some sort of technology that the military was deploying to soldiers to where they could have all of their health records embedded in their skin like a digital tattoo of some sort.
Dr. Hepburn showed us a few current projects. Some sound like they're from an episode of Star Trek. Consider a ship like the USS Theodore Roosevelt, hobbled last year when 1,271 crew members tested positive for the coronavirus. What if everyone on board had their health monitored with this subdermal implant, now in late-stage testing? It's not some dreaded government microchip to track your every move, but a tissue-like gel engineered to continuously test your blood.
It's a sensor.
This tiny green thing in there?
That tiny green thing in there, you put it underneath your skin, and what that tells you is that there are chemical reactions going on inside the body, and that signal means you're going to have symptoms tomorrow.
Wow. There's an actual transmitter in that?
Yeah, it's like a check engine light.
Check this sailor out before he infects other people.
That's right.
Sailors would get the signal, then self-administer a blood draw and test themselves on site.
Look at that.
We can have that information in 3 to 5 minutes. As you truncate that time, as you diagnose and treat, what you do is you stop the infection in its tracks.
Are you familiar with that technology?
I am very familiar with that technology, but I did not know that it was in the James Bond films.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was just science fiction fantasy at the time. But they actually have that quantum patch nanodot technology now. It was developed at MIT University with funding from Bill Gates again, where they can use these little micro needles to inject a invisible tattoo under your skin, like on your hand or your wrist. And then all they have to do is you can't see anything unless you put it under an infrared light. And when it's under an infrared light, the QR code shows up and shows the data points of whether you've been vaccinated, when your last vaccination was. And so they have this technology. I think the idea is to put it on our phones first. I don't think they're going to go directly to the embedded skin invisible tattoo. But once people get used to it on their phones, I think, the horses will be out of the barn. It will be too late to get a handle on this and stop it from marching forward, which is going to be ever more intrusive and invasive technology.
Sure. When I read about technology like this, especially when I read about the digital tattoos, it made me think about my Sunday school learning about the mark of the beast and how you have to have a mark on your hands, on your forehead before you're able to do any commerce or go buy anything, that kind of thing. Do you see this as a potential precursor to something like that? Could this be something like that?
Well, Ronald Reagan had a famous quote in his farewell address of 1989. He said, "Don't be afraid, quote, don't be afraid to see what you see," unquote, meaning your eyes don't fool you. If it looks like a duck, it smells like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, there's a good chance that it is a duck. And the scenario that we see being played out before our very eyes in the world today, if you go to France, Italy, Germany, Austria, Australia, Israel, Belgium, the Netherlands, you try going to a pub or a restaurant there if you're not vaccinated. And in some of the countries now, they're extending it to grocery stores. So it is moving in that direction where it seems like you won't be able to buy or sell if you don't have the mark. Now, you can argue whether that is the mark or just a mark leading up to perhaps the mark. But any way you want to look at it, it certainly seems to fit the bill of what we read in Revelation 13.
You certainly give the example of that in Austria, in Australia, parts of Germany, actually, as well. I've seen different videos where police are literally walking through a marketplace and asking to see their papers.
Yeah,
you know, which is very, very scary in a lot of ways. And I know that they're beginning to talk now in the news about banning people from flying if they can't prove that they've been vaccinated.
And they're already talking about the driver's license as well.
That I had not heard yet. Tell me about that.
Yes, Utah is the first state to consider linking people's vaccine status to their driver's license. And other states are looking into it. We will have to watch this very carefully. It would certainly make sense because in these European countries, you cannot right now ride public transportation in a lot of these countries unless you show your digital vaccine passport and it has a green light, meaning you're up to date on your latest booster shot. So in America, most people are not reliant on public transportation. We don't ride the bus and the and the subway as much as people do in Europe. And so if they want to tighten this control grid, they would probably have to apply it to the driver's license. They're already applying it in a lot of areas of our country to healthcare. There's been stories of people being denied critical organ transplants because they didn't have their COVID shot. You've probably seen those.
Yeah.
And so I think healthcare, transportation, and your job are the three ways that they're going to try to bring this thing in and force everybody to get it. And of course, also, it's going to be tied in with the new digital money system. More than 65 nations across the world right now, Jim, their central banks in more than 65 countries are testing out and experimenting with a new digital programmable money system that is based on blockchain technology. China is well down the road with this. India, Sweden, the United States Federal Reserve is kind of behind the others, but is also starting to look into a digital money system. And so I predict that within the next 2 or 3 years, cash will be completely phased out, and we will be all forced to use a centralized digital money system, which will then be connected to this digital health passport, see? And so that way, if you're not compliant with the government rules and edicts, and you're not up to date with your shots according to the latest government mandate, all they have to do is shut down your digital money account, and you'll have no more access to money. That's where this is going. That's where they want to take it.
Sounds all very draconian in my view. Leo Holman, if someone wanted to get in contact with you and hear more about what you have to say, how can they find you?
They can find me at my website, which is just my name, leoholman.com. That's last name is spelled H-O-H-M-A-N-N, leoholman.com. And I really do urge people to read this article. We didn't have too much time to get into it, but it explains how the digital global ID system that international forces are working towards implementing has to do with more than just vaccines. In their own words, they say that it will apply to your work environment, your educational records, your financial, it says your financial records will be included on the digital ID system, and everything else. So read that article. And if you and if you like what you see there, then please sign up for email alerts and you'll get an email every time I post a new article on my website.
Yeah, I found your article very fascinating, and I sincerely hope that you're wrong.
I hope that I'm wrong, too. I hope that I'm wrong, too. The only question, I think, is when and how soon they can implement this system,
yes.
Jim. Yes. Not if, but when.
Yeah. Interesting times we live in, sir. Interesting times. Thank you so much for being on the show. I do appreciate you.
Indeed. Thank you, Jim.
Well, my time is up. I thank you for yours. I'll see you again real soon right here with a brand new episode. Until next time, bye-bye.